Hi, and welcome to Leto Narrative Dissidents. This is Season 2, Episode 8, Eclipse Phase, Second Edition, a game of transhuman science fiction horror put out by Posthuman Studios. This is a game near and dear to my heart, and in the interests of disclosure, I am slightly biased in this game, as I have written for it multiple times. In fact, I have written for the core book, second edition, and I've written for several other supplements. So I am Ross Payton, and with me, as always, are my co-hosts.
I am Ross Payton, a sinner.
Massively biased.
Yes, and these are not forks of me with a voice changing. These are actually different people, Greg Stolze and James Wallace. So,
Heyo.
Evening.
I guess I should be the one to explain the basic premise of the game before we get into it, of what the game does. What the game does is present, I think probably the most important thing to understand with Eclipse Phase is what sets it apart from other science fiction games, or at least most science fiction games, because there are games that actually I think that do this, but they're very few. Most science fiction games, they'll take one or a handful of ideas and create a setting based on them, you know, like Mothership is like, or Aliens, or a lot of like, or Travelers, like, mostly it's the spaceships. It's faster than light technology, and then extrapolating based on that. Shadowrun would be Cyberpunk would be cybernetics. But in Eclipse Phase, they say, well, just everything in technology has been advanced to the point of, as far as it can possibly go, you know, it is not exactly what you would call hard science fiction, but it takes a lot of technology has advanced. Everything technologically has been advanced.
I'd say it's pretty hard in the sense of difficult.
Yeah.
Ow.
Well, hard in the sense of like trying to,
it's trying extrapolate. To make it realistic, trying to have it obey the laws of physics. It makes me, and trying to not hand wave away the implications of these technologies. Right. As you were talking just now, Ross, I'm like, oh, like another game we talked about, which was Continuum, where, you know, Feng Shui is a time travel game, but it's like, it's very upfront about this is time travel so that you can have ancient kung fu monks fight killer cyborgs from the future. Yeah. And Continuum was, this is time travel about what really would happen if you went back and changed the past. And, you know, if you could time travel, then you would also be space traveling and also this. And, well, then there's that. And you would meet yourself. And when you met yourself, you would. And so I think Eclipse Phase is closer to the Continuum approach than the Feng Shui approach. Although I do think they really like to have their action-y bits too.
Yeah, I would compare it actually more to Blue Planet in terms of being an immersive, like looking at how technology affects culture and how all of society would change based on all of these technologies and science affecting, you know, society, like, because they're all widely available. The idea isn't that, you know, that you're the one special agent with this one unique special technology and you can go out and do things. No, everyone has access to, or most people have access to, any number of things, because it's transhumanism, which is trans, and that means transition. The idea is it's a whole field of thought in science and in science fiction about, like, how do we go from being human to post-human? Will that happen? Will we transition into a new state, becoming so technologically advanced we are no longer, you can no longer consider us a baseline human? And so Eclipse Phase, it takes all of these ideas, all of these possibilities, and creates an incredibly complex and very rich setting and makes it a horror game. But, you know, it doesn't have to be a horror game. It can be. But the emphasis on horror, because the idea is that our technology has run amok and most of humanity was wiped out in an apocalyptic event. And what's left is scrabbling to survive, wondering what will happen in the future. Because while your characters are technically immortal, there are existential threats that could wipe out all life in the universe, as we know, or at least all humans. Like, there are threats so powerful. You're like, you have, your mind is backed up, but what happens, there are threats that can wipe out your backup server. That's the idea. So it's a game for exploring
the solar system where your backup server is hosted.
Yes, exactly. Yep. And so it's a game for exploring a lot of interesting ideas for philosophical, just like really... like really in what it means to be science fiction. Like, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean? What are fates worse than death? And boy, there's a lot of them in Eclipse Phase. And how would society change if we were really a post-scarcity society? What does capitalism look like that? What does a post-capitalist society look like? A reputation-based economy. So it explores all of these things. It takes a lot to get into it, but I think it's a very rewarding game to play if you like really tackle these ideas head on in your games. So that's sort of like the basic pitch for it. And second edition does a lot in the very beginning to explain some of the main highlights of the game. I guess that's kind of where we'll get start overall impression. So James, what were your overall impressions of the game?
This is a big game. I mean, I don't just mean it's a 430-page book. It's, I was just for an exercise actually trying to see how many words that is, and I copied all the words out of the PDF and dropped them into a Google document, and Google documents crashed. It's that big. There are, I would say, at least 12 hours of reading in here. It is a very substantial, well-fleshed-out universe, I think almost well-fleshed-out to a degree that most GMs are not going to need. It covers an awful lot of bases. You can do an awful lot with this game. And I think my impression is that actually that's what the designers wanted. They wanted this to be a system that, although it comes on quite hard as it's, okay, it's post-human, transhuman, actually, if you want to do a post-apocalypse game, you can do it. If you want to do exciting cyberpunk, you can do it. If you want to do espionage thrillers in the near future, you can do it. If you want to do psionic warfare, there's psionics. It was the moment I hit the psionics rules, I just went, this is a kitchen sink game. They've chucked in everything. They do not have a clear single path vision for this. They're not writing a series of science fiction novels. They're going, have at it. You can do anything. It's absolutely fine. You can do almost any form of science fiction here other than big, epic star battles. You can't do Star Wars. No. The rest of it, there are, with a few tweaks, there are very, very few forms of science fiction that you couldn't do with this RPG. I think, and I was going to say this
sounds
again,
like Trinity.
I think it's a spiritual successor to Traveller, actually. Traveller was a game that just kind of threw you in at the depot and went, here you go, here's a universe, you've got a scout ship, go, and there could be anything out there. This is more tightly defined, but there's a hell of a lot you can do with it. Mm-hmm. And then you hit the rules, which are massively overcomplex.
Your point about Star Wars is sort of like, Star Wars, you know, is technically a science fiction setting. You know, you have FTL,
yeah,
space.
It's science,
but like,
it's science fantasy.
It's science fantasy, but like, the way in Star Wars, despite having FTL ships and weapons that can destroy entire planets and blah blah blah, all the spaceship fights look like World War II dogfights, because that's what the first movie
did.
Oh
no, they don't. Look like World War I dogfights.
Well, like George Lucas was famously inspired by like World War II.
Was it World War?
Yeah.
Could be wrong. It's
633 Squadron. He used footage from 633 Squadron in early test prints of Star Wars.
Okay, but they were non jet fights, right?
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. World War II, like, and so like that's the incongruity here. Eclipse Phase is like, well, if you had spaceships, you could do, I don't know, FTL attack maneuvers or whatever. If you had this, you could do this, and like. And so everybody would do the most logical thing, like they would back up their brains. They would do this, and so like there are space battles in Eclipse Phase, but they're basically so complicated and dangerous that it's impossible to. It's like, well, you're just all gonna die because space is very dangerous.
It's unforgiving. This was something I ran into working on Termination Shock, where I get to the, you know, okay, what are ship fights like? And I'm like, wow, yeah, space will kill you even if it doesn't have help from a person. And I'm like, yeah, you can't dodge a laser beam. there's no way 10 tons of steel are going to avoid a laser that's aimed at it. It's like saying, oh, you know, yeah, the garage is just going to dodge it when I try and shine this flashlight beam on it. That doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, I'm like, at most, it's going to be like old naval engagements where they're sitting back and letting rip with the 10-inch guns. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not going to look like a dogfight. It's going to be, okay, we are shooting at that tiny, tiny, tiny glittering speck out there, or it's come and rammed us and now everything is a boarding action, or it's going to be, oh yeah, they're not even, you know, they're not trying to shoot us. It's a cyber attack. They're trying to take over our ship and instruct the life support system to switch to aerosolized bleach.
Yeah. There's a famous series of essays or an essay that I read online years ago called There Ain't No Stealth in Space, you know, talking about how thermal heat signatures are impossible to hide. There's no way to cloak your ship in space, and talking about like what space combat would be like based on like what we know of physics. And it's like, yeah, you're just all gonna fucking die. Like, it's just, it's so incredibly dangerous. So that's why Eclipse Phase doesn't worry on ship battles, because like, it's, yeah, there's also more interesting things to do in this, because some of the technologies mentioned in Eclipse Phase are body resleeving, mind backups through the ego and morph in the parlance of the game. Your mind can be is a digital file that can be stored on a computer and backed up and copied. So you can fork your mind, copy it, put in multiple bodies. You can put your mind in a organic human body, in a robotic body, or a pod morph, which is like a Terminator style cyborg, part flesh, part machine. There are uplifts, animals that have been given human level intelligence. There are AGIs, AIs with human level intelligence. There's nanotechnology. What else? I'm sure.
Question.
Fabrication, right. Nanofabrication. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Let me ask this of you, Ross, the E-Phase fanboy. what character do you think you would relate to more on a visceral, emotional level? The Morkborg guy with the mask and the compulsive nose picking, or the Eclipse Phase character who's an AI in a body that's a cloud of nanobots?
That's a good question, because they talk about like how difficult it can be to resleeve into a body you're not used to. There are mechanics to handle that. But I think like in terms of like, putting your body into a swarm of nanomachines, I could get used to it. There would be a way to do that.
Wouldn't it be like getting into a hot bathtub and you just,
another thing is that they have simulation tech, virtual reality simulation technology that's so good that it's indistinguishable from reality without, and a time accelerated simul space. So like, even if I'm in, my mind is inside or more sleeved into this nanoswarm, I could put my mind into a simulation where I'm in a meat body. And then maybe, I don't know, you know, am I the man who dreams he's a butterfly, or butterfly dreams of a man?
And this has been used as a plot device in role-playing games. God, I remember 1992, I think, having a convention game with Eric Wujek, the designer of Amber, in which, no, it wasn't. It was one of, I think it was Brian Nystal or Mike Nystal of the Nystal brothers. And it started off, it was a fantasy game. And then there was one of those kind of jarring moments, and other stuff was going on in a completely different universe. And then we were back to the fantasy universe. Fantasy universe was a VR simulation, and we were, in fact, in cryosleep in a spaceship. And it works so well in roleplay, because you can't test the resolution. You can't, you know, go, oh, you know, I think this might be a simulation. You know, the resolution is as good within the imaginary VR as it is within the imaginary reality. So that's not a new idea. And in fact, I was reading through this. I had an intense flashback to sitting in an airport with Dennis Detwiller after, I think it was the Gamma Trade Show in 2000, and he was pitching games to me, one of which was one in which you are a disembodied mind in a digital system, and nobody knows how they got there. And you're just trying to work out what this system is and who built it, and if you can get out, if there is an out, and I was really excited by that, but we were in the middle of putting Nobilis together. I said, I'll get back to you when we do Nobilis, and I did, and he was busy, and that was that. Mm. But yeah, so this is not new concepts, but they're still really strong and lend themselves very well to roleplay.
So Have either of you read the Ed Regis book, Great Mambo Chicken and the Transhuman Condition?
Mm-mm. No.
It's really good. It's extremely funny. It's a piece of science reportage. It reminds me of Mary Roach's work. And what Ed Regis did was talk to people who, and this was published in, you know, at the end of the 20th century, mm-hmm. and people were like, oh yeah, within 5 years, we're going to be able to upload our minds into perfect computer simulations and live forever. And I'm going to fork myself 10,000 times, fire myself off on rockets to every corner of the galaxy. And in 100,000 years, all my disparate selves will return and reunite and have this giant party, and we'll probably need to scrap an entire solar system just to have enough aluminum for the beer cans for it. So that is one side of it, is, you know, what do transhumanists really think is going to happen?
Yeah.
And then the second part of it, and they're blended together, is what actually is happening with all these technologies, and the gap between what they expect and what is actually occurring. It's like what they expect is immortality within our lifetimes. We will be the last generation that has to die. And what winds up happening is cops busting this dude in a public park where he's pouring dry ice into coolers full of severed heads, and him saying, this isn't what it looks like, officer. These people all signed up for this. They're going to live forever when we get the technology to reconstruct their bodies. But I lost my, but the power went out at the head storage facility.
No. I mean, yeah, these are ideas that have been batted around for decades, at least. If you look at the references section, they have a list of novels and comics and nonfiction books and role-playing games and movies and TV.
That date back decades. Mambo Chicken ain't on there.
Yeah, well, like, and that's only a partial list, but these were, like, you know, they have things like Ghost in the Shell and, like, Ray Kurzweil's writing and just...
Hans Moravec.
Yep, and so there's taking this, all this stuff and making this stew of like a cohesive setting where you can take any, like explore any of the ideas of transhumanism or a lot of these science fiction ideas and run a game, like a one shot or a campaign or whatever, and just really have fun with it. And just like, see how, you know, if you want to do like Dead Space style survival horror where you're fighting weird monsters on an abandoned space station, you can do that. You can, like I said, it's kitchen sink setting, but it's meant to be cohesive so that your characters are able to do a little bit of everything or really dive into one thing. And like, if worse comes to worst, you can always be restored from backup because firewall's got your back. Probably, maybe. Depends on what firewall is in your campaign, because they leave a lot of things up in the air so you can sort of customize it for your campaign. But like, that's the appeal, is like very few other RPGs cover these kind of things. Like, there's a lot of science fiction RPGs, but a lot of them are just like dudes in spaceships, you know, zipping around space, or like cyberpunk games. Like, those are the two flavors of science fiction I see. And nobody else is like, you know, let's really explore what this technology would do to us and what the implications are. And like, Blue Planet's, out of the games I'm familiar with, is the one other game that is really like, all right, all these technologies exist. What are the implications and how would society change based on it? And I find that a lot more interesting than the Star Wars things. Like, yeah, we have FTL ships, but we're still dogfighting because sure, it looks cool. Yeah, don't think about it, you know?
Yeah, we can work more effectively when we switch the technology off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the moment you go, yeah, this is fantasy, sure.
Yeah, exactly. So like, this is trying to actually be science fiction. It can be very daunting to run or play, because like, if a player outthinks you, it's like, oh, well, I can use this technology in this way to totally solve your scenario. You're like, well, damn, you really can't you? Huh.
I need to go to the bathroom.
Let me
talk among yourselves.
5 minute smoke break. Let me. Suddenly, there's an exurgent virus outbreak. But yeah, we should probably get into, I guess, a little of the core mechanics of how the game works. Or I mean, but well, I guess in terms of what the game does is there are, I guess before we get into the mechanics, there are a couple of like paradigms, like campaign frameworks that it, that the game mentions like on 24 and 25 of like, here's how you can run your campaign. Here, you don't have to focus on any of it. You can just like focus on some of it. Firewall, which is the framing organization, that they're kind of like Delta Green, but in space, and it's different.
They're cops, but you're trying to bust Cthulhu.
You're volunteer secret cops, like,
because nothing ever went wrong with a bunch of undertrained, enthusiastic volunteer freelance police.
Exactly. Then there's gatecrashing, which is, you know, like I said, this is technically kind of hard sci-fi, but they throw in some like fantastic elements like the Pandora Gate.
It's Stargate.
Yeah, planet of the week, baby. Great stuff.
If I was gonna play Eclipse Phase, that's probably what I'd want to play.
Oh, the gatecrashing book is great. You just read it, like, it's just descriptions of planets with weird stuff on them. Like, here's a planet with something weird. Here's something. No, oh man, this planet is really weird, you know? And it's great because you can always make up a new planet and like have something weird on it. And like, that's your game. And then the final real paradigm is criminal. Like, you can just be cyberpunks doing jobs. You don't have to be firewall. You could just be, because like, there is crime, and even though it's post-scarcity, there are criminals. And like, what do? Well, they do horrible things like soul trafficking. What's that? Well, if your mind's a file, people can steal it and then copy you and edit that file to make you into a slave, or copies of you into slaves, or steal your memories and like other horrible things, fate worse than death. And maybe you're criminals who fight, you know, the soul traffickers or corporations, or who knows. So those are you pick one of these paradigms and you build characters for it and you go on missions. And that's sort of what the game does on a high level. And there's a little sidebar describing other possible campaign models, like mercenaries, research teams, political stuff, Earth survival, which is the real survival horror, Resident Evil, Dead Space kind of thing, because Earth is just a horror zone filled with warm, you know, it's Skynet, it's Terminator, Skynet future.
Have they set it up so you can just be like the dudes who own a place that's a coffee shop by day and then serve some drinks at night, and the whole game is just hanging out with gate crashers and criminals and talking to people about their stuff? Maybe you throw a little romance angle in there.
Yeah. You could. I think you were going very much against the designer's intention there. This is a game with, I think it's, I can't reference the PDF. Because here's my first gripe. This is a 430-page book. I bought the PDF, and you read through the text, and it'll go, okay, now here's so-and-so, and we're referring to a bit in another chapter, and there'll be a little arrowhead triangle and the page number. And you click on it on the PDF, and nothing happens, because they've put no hyperlinks in the entire document. Well, so you're scrolling backwards and forwards in this 430-page document. So I'm not going to be doing that. Character generation comes down, I think, and it's comparatively bare bones, is about 8 pages. The combat system is 40 pages, and that's before you get into mesh combat and space combat, all of which have their own sections elsewhere. It is, in rules terms, by far the biggest section of the book, and when you do that in a rule book, what you are saying is, this is a book in which you are expected to fight an awful lot. Yep. Because D&D is exactly the same. The vast majority of the rules are about how you fight things.
I mean, that's pretty much true of every game we've reviewed.
See, what I've got is that character creation is 45 pages.
45 pages?
The chapter on it is 45 pages long.
Well, if you look at the table of contents, character starts
something
on
else in that case. Something else is 8. No, that's it. Skill resolution. Basic skill resolution, I think, is 4 pages. Right. Yes, it's combat is the same as character generation, and the character generation section also covers all the skills and all the classes and all the backgrounds and all the rest. Mm-hmm. So, creating your character is as important as making them fight.
Yeah, because you don't have to worry about losing your character. There can always be a backup.
You'll just get bored of them.
Yep.
Or not.
I mean, it'll take a while. I know in the campaigns I've run and played in, everyone got really connected to their character pretty early on, because you can make such a detailed character with interesting stuff to you. So the basic game mechanics are very short, that's, you know, 30 to 35, but it's a percentile system, similar to Deltagreen and Unknown Armies. Doubles,
I thought it
crits.
Looked more like Unknown Armies than anything else.
It does have flipping, but yeah, blackjack rules for opposed tests, you know, highest it doesn't go over.
Mm-hmm.
It does have multiple pools for, now this is a much improvement over the first edition, which did not have these pools, but you just had Moxie in the first edition. But in second edition, you have pools that you can use to give yourself bonuses.
These are a limited resource. So it's like you got 3 points in your, what was the cool one? What was the one I liked? Which was the flex pool, which I have in my notes as the meta game good shit.
Narrative wild. Yeah, wild card may be used for narrative control as well as rerolling. Yeah, they do recharge. You have to rest to do that. You can also use them. So there's insight, moxie, vigor, and flex. Insight is for mental things. Moxie is for social. Vigor is for physical. And flex is for, as a wild card. Aside from flipping rolls or gaining a bonus on them, you can also, like vigor, you can ignore a wound, which this combat does. Combat, there are wound penalties. If you take too much damage, you'll be fighting that penalty. Yeah, it's a way that your character does, like your characters have more narrative control and are more powerful than, say, like a Deltagreen agent. But like, that doesn't mean they're invincible or overpowered, because the things they're facing are also very powerful, you know?
I mean, other than the whole you can't die thing.
Right.
I'm like, okay, so we're doing horror where you can't die. That's an interesting, make no small plans there, Eclipse Phase designers. So in your experience, Ross, is it scary to play Eclipse Phase and it's like, oh shit, I am an undying piece of software and I'm scared?
Yeah, because of the two factors. One, you know, the mission you're doing, if I die, I will fail, and that will be disastrous for other people, you know, like, oh God, we found the exurgent in the tunnel and it's going to hit the habitat, you know, where all the innocent civilians are, and that'll destroy the habitat, including their backup servers. So thousands of people will die for real. Maybe I won't, you know, I'll be restored from backup and I won't know what happened. And that'll take a major hit knowing that I failed. I can be corrupted. Someone can get access to my mind and then read my secrets. If they can, you know, open up the hard drive in my brain and access all my secrets.
When you said I could be corrupted, I just pictured an Eclipse Phase evolved gorilla. It's like, what? You mean there's another evolved gorilla who's got all my memories but is running around yelling, "Hail Chaos"?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the big scary thing in the setting is the exurgent virus, which is a virus that no one knows how it works. It is so advanced that it might as well be magic to them, to the people in Eclipse Phase, and it can do incredibly terrifying things, including making you into like a sleeper agent, like a Manchurian candidate, and you would never know. And then there are things where, like, yeah, that backup server is there most of the time, but sometimes it's not. Like in the original RPPR campaign, No Evil, we had this moral dilemma that we totally did the wrong thing in terms of like, okay, we have this NPC who can help us. And we snuck into this resleeving facility and there's this other NPC. He's being restored from backup right now. His mind is being loaded into an organic body right now. We could delete him forever for real and load our helpful NPC into him to steal his identity. And like, it would help us, but boy, that's a shitty thing to do. That's evil. Like, well, we're going to do it because we need to do it because of the mission. And so the horror comes from like, oh, I'm becoming the monster, a lot of the time. And then I have been turned into something like, it's transhumanism. Are you going to become the thing that you want to become? Like, or are you going to be corrupted?
I felt really guilty about what I did to those puppies until I edited my psychospace so that I no longer feel empathy for puppies.
Or I just deleted that memory of that Like, I don't remember killing the puppies. What puppies? What are you talking about? I'm a good guy. I would never.
What's a puppy? I don't know what a puppy is.
Like, it's, again, not so much about losing your humanity as losing your transhumanity.
When you start thinking about it, from what you can just start, it's very easy to come up with utterly horrifying things that can happen to you. And that, yeah, so the game becomes like, oh, yeah, this is so much worse than just dying. I wish I just died. This is worse. I don't like this at all. Yeah, that's what happens in the Eclipse Phase campaigns. There, or at least in my experiences, that the stakes are so much higher. Like, and yeah.
So it's like it's like Vince Baker in Apocalypse World with the approach that, okay, your job as a GM is to root for the characters, but at the same time give them tough choices that really matter. Mm-hmm. And in a horror milieu like this, where the characters are so profoundly empowered, you know, I'm like, there's where it's also like Unknown Armies, is that often the acquisition of power is either a result of, or opens up the possibility of, you now have the chance to do some terrible, terrible things.
Oh boy, don't you? Yeah.
Or you are required to do some terrible, terrible things. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you can add Delta Green in there too, where it's like, oh yes, you have all kinds of authority and power on the human scale. You are, you know, if you want someone dead, you're a cop. You're just going to kill them and cover it up. You won't even come under suspicion because you're in the FBI and you know how to do this, and it would be cold-blooded and not in the heat of passion. But still,
yeah.
What is so bad that it makes it okay to do that in comparison?
Mm-hmm.
The answer being Cthulhuid horrors.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Yep. I mean, they talk about like how in order to create uplifts, like animals, primarily certain birds, primates, pigs, and octopuses have been given human level intelligence. And they talk about in order to make uplifts, they ran these octopuses through these trials, and the top 10%, the smartest ones, they killed the other 90%. And then raised a new generation. They did it again and again and again and again. So they killed millions of animals in order to create, you know, uplifted animals. And so, like, and they're also, guess what? They're not considered like people in the inner system, in what they call Sunward, from Mars all the way to Mercury. They're just considered property. They don't have rights. Same with AGI. So, like, yeah, slavery's really, in a big way, a main theme.
You know,
yeah.
Well, I mean, you're not going to have, anytime you have capitalism, there's going to be the temptation to be like, man, wouldn't it be great if we had a workforce that didn't need sick days or
mm-hmm.
pay or respect? Man, that's always going to be the dark dream mm-hmm. of a profit generating enterprise.
Yeah. Another thing is also this immortality is like you can be put in different bodies. So like for the majority of people, they're what they call in the game, the clanking masses. They're kept in cheap robotic, you know, bodies to do work. And they have, you know, horrible work conditions and, you know, no one cares because they're robot bodies. And so like there are millions of people in the setting that like were killed 10 years ago. They were in human bodies. They were born in human bodies. They were killed by godlike AIs 10 years ago. Then they're reawoken. It's like, all right, if you work this mine on Mars for 10 years, we'll give you a better body. And so they're stuck working in a robot body for 10 years after being murdered by essentially a Terminator. And they have missing
but
memories.
But the good news is your new body can't feel pain.
Oh, it can't. Something. Yeah, 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 exactly. You can turn your pain receptors off. It's fine.
Let me show you where your squelch knob for that is. You're gonna want that.
Mm-hmm. They don't need to sleep. You don't need to sleep either. So, good luck. Yeah, the horror's there. I think that's kind of going over what the game
does it do, and yeah. then how does it do it. So yeah, I'm like, it reads to me like the designer and I grew up steeped in the same percentile antecedents, but I don't know. The impression I got is that Eclipse Phase has a lot of edge cases and special circumstances and if but rules, and I'm not sure it needs them all. None of them, I'm like, this makes no sense. This is garbage. Everything, you can see why it was done that way. But there were a number of times where I questioned whether it needed to be done at all.
Mm. I concur. I think it's massively over complex for what it is. Not just in terms of the background, but the rules in particular. And despite that, it feels curiously old school. Characters are defined by what they can do, not who they are. You look at any of the sample characters in the book, you get no idea of who this personality is, what they want, you know, how they behave. You know exactly what they can do in extreme detail. The character sheets are very dense with information. They are not easily parsed. I set up a group ready to play test it. I read through not the whole rule book. I read through the starter set to start with. Mm-hmm. And just came to the end and went, I cannot run this game. This is a game in which every attack in combat has a 9-stage process you need to work through. Which I can't remember. That was the other thing. I was finding I was getting to the end of a lot of pages, flipping the page, not remembering the rules on the previous page. My memory is not great, but I can usually remember, you know, the structure of the thing and how it holds together. This was just slipping away like sand between open fingers. It's very solid. It's very mechanical. I will defer to you on how it actually runs. All I knew was this is not the kind of role-playing game that I felt capable of running.
So the first edition, I believe, came out in 2009. I bought it at the Gen Con. It came out. I just heard about it. I was like, ooh, this sounds great. I bought it. I started reading it on the way back home from Gen Con, and I didn't feel confident enough to run until like early 2011. So like a little over a year of just me reading the book, thinking about it, like, what the hell do I do with this game? And eventually, once I ran, it's like, things started to click. But it is mechanically, yeah, a very complex game. There's a ton of things to keep track of. The developers, Post-Human Studio, Adam Jerry and Rob Boyle, previously worked on Shadowrun, which I believe shows in this, especially with like the list of like, you know, cybernetic mods you can get for your characters, the list of guns. Mm-hmm. I do not fault anyone for not being wanting to jump this system mechanically. Now, there is a fate they have commissioned Eclipse Phase fate rules, which is still complex, obviously, but like, better than easier than which I've not played.
Could you make it? How much could you boil this down without losing its essential e-phase-ness? Mm-hmm. Because I'm like, okay, what is the special sauce of Eclipse Phase? And I would argue that that is the sleeving and forking. And they're like, no, we are gonna a lot of other games either. You know, hand wave, just what a big deal that would be. Mm-hmm. Or they nerf it and they're just like, no, we are getting into what everyone else is kind of shying away from. And so, you know, kudos to them on picking that nub and then building. That's the hub of the wheel. And there are a whole lot of spokes on a very wide wheel. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if it was me, it would just be like, okay, you're going to have a simple ego and you're going to have simple shells. And yeah, you could boil this down, I feel. But maybe the people who are really into it don't want a stripped down, simplified, one role player facing thing. They want a deeply complex, no, the GM has to roll two because then they can also get critical fails. Super sticky, techy, finicky, fiddly system because they are in a super sticky, techy, finicky, fiddly setting.
A lot of the core audience for this game are people who are interested in transhumanism. I know one of the first scenarios that Caleb ran, in fact, I think the very first one is the scenario called Think Before Asking, which was written it's a fan scenario. It was written by this guy named Anders Sandberg, who is a Swedish researcher, futurist and transhumanist. He has a Wikipedia article. You know, he has a PhD in computational neuroscience. And he wrote, and like one of the concepts in Eclipse Phase are what they call seed AIs, which are self-improving AIs, AIs that can figure out how to make themselves smarter. And that's a big problem. The AIs that killed off 90% of humanity are called Titans, and they were seed AIs. They got too smart and decided, well, let's just kill all the humans. And no one knows exactly why they did that, but they did.
It's very Skynet.
Yeah.
In the real world AI and the real world of technological development that we've seen over the last couple of years, it's like you would just laugh at that. You're like, there's no profit in AI that works better and better as time goes on. What you would want is to start off with a great AI that gradually gets dumber so that people have to put more resources into making it work, because that's where the gravy train is.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe I'm just being cynical about ChatGPT and the AI stuff I've been seeing lately.
Well,
there's part of me that's like, this is as good as it's going to get. It's just downhill from here, like Twitter.
You know, and Think Before Asking, the problem is there's a seed AI, and they call it the Gorgon in a box problem. There's a Gorgon inside the box, and we want to figure out what it is doing. Fortunately, we will turn to stone if we see her face, and she might try to make us see it. So it's sort of, you know, like we know they built a seed AI, and they don't know exactly what it's doing. And if they look at it, maybe it'll like do something.
Maybe something good.
Yeah.
Maybe something bad.
Exactly.
This being Eclipse Phase, my money's on bad.
And so, like, yeah. I think the core fans of Eclipse Phase are fine with a super complex system because they want things very granular and crunchy because, like, if you just sort of hand wave, it's like, I have 5 points of tech. Like a gumshoe game or Knights Black Agents, where you're just like, oh, I'm just going to spend 4 points of hacking and I do the thing. Well, you know, that he may do something that's technically impossible in the setting. So it's like, no, you have an engineer nano swarm and you can program it to do this, or you can, you know, do this. Or so I think these sort of like fine differences are important to a lot of Eclipse Phase fans.
It's a tactical kind of game as opposed, mm-hmm. you know, it's focused on actions and events and the simulation of physics more than it is on feelings, personalities, and the simulation of the interior experience.
Like, I think, again, in Think Before Asking, it was like, we put the AI in a simul space, a simulated reality, and put that one in a simulated reality, and put that one in a simulated reality, so we don't actually know what the AI is doing anymore. And so we don't want to look in, open up, go all the way down to its level of simulated reality. So yeah, that may be a little dangerous. And these are the kind of things you do in Eclipse Phase. It's like you need, so I think having these level of like your characters can do exactly these kind of things. And there is some stuff about role playing on the pre-generated characters which are the motivations, which you can use to gain or recharge your pool points. For example, the first character, Dante, has motivations in joy, life, science, and Venusian interests. That's not a lot, but there's also a couple of paragraphs of text at the bottom. But it requires you to understand the setting very well to get, like, what that character is like or how to roleplay as them.
What does it mean to be a Venusian?
Yeah, which means you need to read the Venus section in the book and also read the other sections about, like, how Venus relates to other, you know, polities, a word I did learn from Eclipse Phase, because like when you're a space station, you're not really a nation, right? But like if you're a sovereign political entity.
I mean, yeah, this part of this, and this is just sort of endemic to the science fiction endeavor, is, you know, I had in my notes, I'm like, anytime I saw a word in context and I didn't know what it was, I would just jot it down and then go read later what I'm like, okay, exurgent, scum, ectomy, res, ultimates, vulcanoids, titans, factors, bracewell, prometheans, ozma. And that's, you know, and it's hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a four-page glossary at the back. Double columned. I'm going to hazard that's got several hundred entries in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of jargon for the game. That is definitely
true. And as a designer, I'm like, oh, I get it. Because you want to have a word for pieces of the mechanics, right? Mm-hmm. You know, in Unknown Armies, it's charges. In Delta Green, it's sand. In here, it's, I don't know why they have res instead of experience.
I don't know exactly why they call that. I don't know.
It's an XP, my dude. It's just an XP. But at the same time, so you kind of need to have a specialized jargon for the mechanics. But in a science fiction game, you also want to have, you know, words for the cool stuff in your setting. Mm-hmm. And now you're running into, okay, people are not going to be able to keep all this together unless, you know, you will have a few super vocabulary nerds who get way into it and love it. But you will also get, you know, a number of people who are just like, this isn't for me because I don't want to have to learn a second language in order to play this game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's worth noting, I'm looking through the glossary at the moment, the four-page glossary is only background terms. It is not game terms. XP is in there for experience playback, experiencing someone else's sensory input, real-time or recorded, aka a sim sense or playback. No reference to experience points whatsoever.
There are no experience points. There's res.
Yeah. Res is not covered in the glossary. It feels slightly like learning a secret language, like you have to assimilate all of this stuff to be allowed entry into what is a fascinating and intricate and very well constructed solar system and beyond. But in the same way, it's the same kind of vibe I got off AD&D back in the 80s when I was discovering role playing. It's mm-hmm. I want to master this system. I want to understand it. I want to be allowed in through the portal of this vocabulary, or in that vocabulary in AD&D's case, which was Gary Gygax's arcane and often entirely unnecessary, obsolete language. You want to get past that. You want to master it and move on, so that you become part of the inner sanctum who understands. And I got the same vibe. I'm not saying it's a bad vibe. I'm saying it's an interesting vibe to encounter in a game in 2022.
Yeah. Well, I think
2023. We did not record this last year.
Yeah. True. It's only February. Don't worry about it. Eclipse Phase set out to cover transhumanist science fiction and science and like these big ideas, you know, like what are the limits of AI? How does you know, what does it mean to be alive when you can copy your mind, and so on and so forth. What does nanofabrication do to society when you can just take junk, shove it into a machine and make it have it, not just 3D print, but just like manufacture anything you need. So you can just a common thing for Eclipse Phase player characters to do is to get like schematics of weapons and tools that they'll need. And then they just hack a nanofabricator wherever they go and to just print out the guns that they need for that job. So they don't need to worry about like smuggling in weapons into like a secure zone. They can just print them there and then use them and then throw them away, or throw them back in the nanofabricator so no one can find them.
And now tomorrow this will be pizza.
Yeah, exactly. How do you cover these? How do you tackle all of these ideas in one game without building a very complex game? Like these are complex ideas. These are like, you know, talking about a scenario where you're like, asked to find out if a seed AI is good or bad when it's nested in all these simulated realities. Well, that's kind of a hard thing to do in like a basic game. Especially when your character's like, you could put it in another setting like, oh, Traveler, but like in Traveler, like those characters wouldn't have the same tools that the Eclipse Phase characters would do. Like, well, I'm going to fork myself and send my fork in, to see what happens to the thing.
Gonna just stick a fork in the socket.
And then, like, okay, your fork comes back and reports this. Like, wait a minute, did the CAI hack my fork? Can I trust myself? Can I trust that version of myself? Better send in another fork, you know, like so on and so forth.
Now, great. Now there are two versions of me, each of them pointing at the other and saying in perfect unison, no, he's the corrupted bad one.
Exactly.
I'm telling you the truth.
Yeah. And there's like, in order to get to that point in a game where all that makes sense, you have to do a lot of, you have to build to that. And like, other role-playing games, I think, are so focused on like, here's the one thing about our game that makes it interesting and moving on, you know, that it doesn't really create that depth that allows you to explore this stuff. So this is, you know, a lot of work, but the payoff is like, you can't experience these kind of games in other, these kind of stories, these kind of scenarios in other games. So I think that's why it is, that's why Eclipse Phase does what it does and how it does it, is through the complexity. It's a feature, not a bug.
But to some people, it's going to be a barrier. It's going to be a feature they don't
100%.
Want.
Yeah.
So. I'm holding my hand up here. I mean, literally, yes, I bounced off it hard.
I believe at this point we should talk about how people play it.
All right. And here's my theory, my E-phase theory. There's going to be forking and sleeving in everything. So you're always going to need to know that. But my guess would be you're probably going to use 60% of what's in the book at most. Mm-hmm. But every group, it's going to be a different 60%.
Yeah.
Forking and sleeving will be there, but you'll have, you know, it's like, oh, no, we're all infomorphs. We're doing an infomorph gatecrasher game where we're just... We are our real selves, our computer programs, but we're sending disposable bodies through these gates to check out cool planets.
Well,
can I just drop in at this point that forking and sleeving sounds, when you say it, sounds completely obscene.
Is this another Urban Dictionary thing, Greg? No. Well, possibly.
In this context. It reminds me of one other thing, and again, this is a separate footnote. The rulebook is very po-faced. There's almost no humor in there. It's very flat. It takes itself very, very seriously. And I was looking for some levity, and there wasn't any. But references to forking and sleeving did cause the corners of my mouth to twitch in an entertaining way.
Well, the source books have a little more humor in them because they're almost like 90% setting material written from characters in the game. So you have little different points of view and they make jokes. I know in some of the material, I've made jokes, little references, slight little references.
A funny thing happened on my way to getting murdered by the Titans.
I mean, you're definitely right, Greg, in terms of like in any one group only using like 60% of the rules. I know like... In my group, I often hand wave or abbreviate mesh hacking rules because it's just to speed things along. You know, a lot of the combat stuff actually got hand waved. A lot of the times, player characters found out ways to deal with. You know, you didn't have to fight because you could either hack them or distract them or lure them away or talk them out of it or sneak by you. Like there's a lot of different ways to solve problems in Eclipse Phase, and it's sort of only limited by your creativity. And your understanding of the setting. I played in a campaign and I've run two campaigns and they've all approached radically different like subjects. Like one was focused on Caleb's Stokes' No Evil campaign was sort of like going through the inner system and dealing with a single grand conspiracy. My first campaign, Duality, was like exploring the outer system as sort of a travelogue. And then my third campaign was all focused almost entirely on Mars as a criminal campaign where the players were all members of the same criminal organization trying to gain power and survive and figure out what happened to them. Because they all woke up in a body bank with some of their memories missing. And like they had to figure out what, you know, where they came from and who they were. And some of them found out, oh, I'm actually a copy. I'm the copy. The real me is, you know, out there living their life. What do I do about that? There's a lot of scale to it. And you're not going to, if you're not interested in gate crashing, you can totally ignore that stuff. If you're not interested in criminals, you can totally ignore that stuff. So yeah.
Well, not even on the sense of the plot level, or setting level, I was thinking the mechanics level. It's like, you know, there are some groups that are going to be like violence you know, good old rock, nothing beats rock. We are just going to be the most violent violencers in a violent planet. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, and for them, every loving nuance of the physical combat system is in play, but they're probably not doing much with, like, ego hacking rules. Mm-hmm. That those might as well not exist. Yep. Or the Thug Life campaign.
Yeah, you can definitely like make characters that are combat monsters and are very scary, but the sort of balancing factor, there's two balancing factors. One, there is a death spiral, both for wounds and mental trauma. So basically, as your character, you know, takes more and more shock and more damage, they get these penalties that stack, and you can ignore them, but those take resources. You know, you have to spend, you know, pool points or have certain cyberware installed to ignore these wounds, and eventually your character is going to be, you know, have so many penalties that they won't be able to do anything effectively. And two, you could be like a hyped up, you know, murder hobo with the coolest rail guns and the fastest, you know, reflexes and everything.
Murder hobo, I beg your pardon, sir. I am a murder tycoon.
Yeah. But like all the GM has to do is like, okay, well, it's a, you know, it's a devouring nano swarm and you don't have any, you forgot to take any defenses against nano swarms, or there's too many nano swarms for your defenses to work against. So you're just going to get eaten by these things and there's nothing you can do about them because they're nano sized. You can't shoot them off because they're on you. They're smaller and they're just going to devour your character from the inside. Or it's an exurgent virus, or you're being hacked. You're very good physically, but you can't defend against a supremely skilled hacker. It's social reputation. Like, well, your character shot up this habitat, and everyone knows it was you. So turns out
people are still pissed about those puppies, man.
Yeah, you don't remember it, but everyone else does. And so everyone just knows you as the guy who blew up the habitat and let all the puppies die. So like you're persona non grata on this habitat, or you're going to have to come up with a new identity and like start over.
I would recommend something not quite so associated with, what was the phrase they used? Puppy side.
Don't worry, we can just clone some more puppies. It's fine. Like we can scrape them up, put them in the machine. And
yeah, the clanking, yapping masses.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah, we could. Yeah, we'll hire somebody to sleeve in to remote control the cyber puppies, and they'll play. They're really good at playing as a puppy. Be just like new. You won't know.
They're into it too. That's okay. So in eclipse phase, if you have not backed up and you are in a meat body that gets killed, there is not actual resurrection technology for that. I mean, because it sounds like it. That's like, well, of course not. There's an edge case. Why would they need to invent that?
Well, basically, all the bodies have a death rating, at which point they've taken so much damage they cannot be resuscitated or fixed. But then you have your cortical stack. Which is an armored hard drive in basically the base of your skull, which can be popped at, you know, pop in stacks. And then, you know, if your buddies are the one who pop your stack, they can take it to a body bank and pop it in, you know, plug it in and put you in a new body. Now that, of course, see, this is also
congratulations. You are now a SIM card.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. But that's the downside is if your enemies win the battle and they get a hold of your stack, well, they're going to be able to read your mind, like literally, as a file.
It's data, your data.
A lot of firewall agents especially will put in a little, I forgot what it's called, but it's a little suicide switch. If this body dies, delete the cortical stack. So it's like,
Great. So now I'm not just on a hard drive. I'm like the porn on the hard drive.
Yeah.
The body dies and I get erased. Great. You're right. This is a horror game.
So the person that gets backed up is, or gets restored from backup is the backup of you before you went on the mission. So you don't know what you did to get killed.
Right.
And so you have to retrace your own steps or figure out what happened and what do they know? And, you know, did they get your mind?
Which is a great plot device. You know, yeah, you wake up from backup and it's yeah, you went on a mission. You didn't come back. Better go and find out what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you what seems like an extremely likely scenario. All right. James and I are playing. Ross, you're running. Mm-hmm. James and I are trying to do something. in the seedy underworld of Enceladus, and you know, our guide betrays us Indiana Jones style, kills us both, and so we get restored, and now James and I know that we can't trust this guy. Mm-hmm. Are we just supposed to suppress our out-of-character knowledge and have our next two backups show up going, oh, hey, Steve, so do you know what happened to our other bodies? No, I don't know what happened to those other bodies. You guys went off on your own.
Well, I mean, it would depend on your characters making, like, investigating your past actions and, like, how well you documented what you did before you died. So you could also probably, there's a lot of stuff in Eclipse Phase on establishing new identities. In fact, having multiple identities. So like back yourself up or put yourself in different bodies than you were, different types of bodies, and give yourself new identities, and then start investigating again. And so the guy who killed you won't necessarily recognize you when you come in again and be like,
God. Okay. That's a pretty good answer. Yeah. Wow.
And
you could
also, like, if you're going to go out, like, go meet with this person you think it's dangerous, have somebody, like, monitoring you from a distance, or, like, a little drone or a robot monitoring your life signs. And, like, if you die, have it send out a signal that the drone gets it, and the drone relays it to some secure communication server. So you get a little, like, oh, yeah, you died at this meet. Like, you're meeting this person, you died. I don't know the details. There's also the emergency, I forgot the name of the device, but there is a cyberware implant. When you die, sends out this massive pulse of energy that contains your ego. So you can be backed up from like deep space. So you're like on an abandoned space station, you know, thousands of AUs away from a planet, and then they still pick it up, but it releases such a large burst of energy that it blows up your body. I forgot what that was called, but like there is like an emergency backup thing, has that. Oh, it was very, it's come up sometimes in game. Emergency Farcaster, a neutrino Farcaster for emergency ego casting if killed or activated. So
it sounds like the answer is you will learn things, and then the person, the version of you that learned them dies, and you just have to pretend you don't know the things you know as a player.
Yeah, I think you have to remember that you have forgotten a bunch of stuff, you cannot use that as character knowledge. And it would be nice if the mechanics had some system in there for dealing with that, though off the top of my head, I have no idea how you would do that.
Yeah, that's hard to mechanize.
Yeah.
I mean, again, like the usually what would happen is that you would have some information. You'd be able to retrace your steps. Like it would be very like information. There were so many, especially for your own character. In the games that I've run, that particular scenario hasn't really. It's been either like you went to the station and you died, and there's no information about it, and then that would be the starting point of the scenario. Like there was a time in No Evil where like we did a okay, we're doing this campaign, we're on this space station, the next session, you wake up on Earth, and you have to do a mission. Like, what? And then at the end of it, we do the mission, but then we're trapped on Earth, which is, you know, this hellscape, and we're all trapped, and we all die. And then the next session, yeah, you don't know what happened to that fork of you. Someone just stole all your minds and, like, sent you on a mission and used you. So you don't know about any of that stuff on Earth. You're like, oh, okay. Great. That was, because Caleb didn't even like reveal who it was that actually sent us on that mission. We don't know. We didn't know as people, as players playing the game. So we couldn't really metagame because we knew something happened, but we don't know who did it to us, which is really the important thing. I mean, yeah, there are sort of metagaming things that can happen and be problems, but in my experience, it doesn't really come up that much.
It's not a frequent and game-breaking problem.
Yeah. I mean, in my experience, characters don't die that often. I mean, it does happen, obviously, but, like...
Yeah.
A lot of times when a player character does die, their buddies are able to retrieve them, or they have a Farcaster, so they get, like, the up-to-date backup, and...
I will never not hear that as Fartcaster, but that is my fault and not the fault of... the authors of Eclipse Phase.
Yeah. Ego casting, by the way, is like how you do FT. Well, deep space travel in Eclipse Space. You just broadcast your mind, you know, your ego to another space station or you know, so you're just transmitting data. You're not sending a physical body over space because that takes a long time. You can go at the speed of light if you're just transmitted to it. You know, say you're on Mars and you want to go to Titan. And so you just have your mind transmitted to Titan and then sleeved into a body there. And that's how you do it. So.
Meanwhile, your Mars fork is just kicking back and taking it easy.
Oh no. Well, I mean, a lot of times you don't even fork. You just send yourself and you're just like, there's a backup of you in cold storage, you know, not activated, but like, you're just there. So, you could fork, but like oftentimes there's a lot of stuff in the book, in the setting, about like how to deal with forks and what the legal rights of forks are. Like a lot of like, you know, like there can only be one Greg Stolze. There can't be two Greg Stolzes legally. Any other, if there's a copy of a Greg Stolze, that's the original Greg Stolze's property, you know, or that needs to be deleted because that's bad.
One of the questions with forks, could I theoretically fork myself a dozen times? And it's like, okay, each of these forks is going to go off and intensively study one martial arts technique for just a month. It's just going to be a month of that one thing. And then at the end, we're going to recombine them. And I will have, it will be as if I intensely studied all of those. Also, I'm going to do this in an accelerated time AI or VR so that it only takes an afternoon.
So yeah, that's called merging of egos, where you take two egos and make, or more and put them into one. Merging often results in mental stress and or lost fork memories. So, the problem with that is, especially with a dozen forks is, see the rules for it are detailed on 296. It is, if you do it, you know, divergence period up to 48 hours, it causes mental stress no matter what. But like for a month, that would be like 2d10 mental damage or 2d6 mental damage and moderate memory loss. So it's extremely traumatic and that's just for two forks. So you can only do two egos at a time. So you could do 1 plus 2 and then 3 plus 4 and just keep adding them until you get one. But then you're basically an NPC.
Pile of jello.
Well, I mean, there are characters that do that in the game. They're called ex-humans, and they are not nice people. Well, they don't want to be people anymore. That's sort of the problem, and that's why Firewall wants to kill them, because they want to do things like that. They change themselves. Again, it's about, like, are we the baddies?
Firewall wants to kill them because they want to be too cool.
Well, they also, yeah, you don't want to, there's what they call singularity seeking. You don't want people, you know, seeking to become godlike, hyper-intelligent beings that have no connection to humanity. That's how you get, you know, existential threats and apocalyptic weapons and all that, you know, bad stuff. So they, ex-humans are kind of like, tend to do that kind of singularity seeking. And so Firewall tends to, eradicate them because they're really dangerous. There is in fact, Anders Sandberg, wrote up a group of ex-humans that did a lot of ego merging. And that was the whole thing, was forking and merging egos and taking bits of egos. Like, oh, this part of this ego is really good at math. This part's good at, you know, firing a gun. We'll merge them together. And then what they make are basically these radical, I forgot what they're called, but they're a faction of things that have no resemblance to humanity. And they're just all very bad and dangerous and totally alien to our understanding. So that's again. That's the part of Eclipse Phase. Do you have the maturity to use this technology without, like, losing yourself?
So, okay, to me, that seems like sort of a cop-out, because here I'm like, oh, you know, it's going to be about all the, you know, yeah, you are loose in the candy store.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like you are loose in the candy store with a stomachache.
Well, it is a horror game, you know. It's not like a power fulfillment thing. It's like the whole point is like we went wild with this technology and it destroyed Earth and like wiped out 90% of the humans. And like now we're trying to figure out what's next. How do we move on?
I guess. I'm like, you know, this is, I'm like, see, but you can't do the thing that you could in Continuum where it's like, oh, I'm just going to fold. I'm just going to jump away, spend a year learning how to play piano excellently, then jump back to 1 second after I left. And, you know, now I can play piano excellently and show that off.
Point of order. Yeah. I don't think you can actually do anything in Continuum because that would require people to understand the rules and to be able to run a game of it. I have run like dozens of games of Eclipse Phase. It is a very teachable game. I have taught my friends how to play. It is. I don't think humans can actually play. I don't think it's a game that can be played. I think.
Yeah. And the advantage that Eclipse Phase has is that you don't have to memorize any pledges before playing.
That's true.
Yes. But you say, I mean, it's the swings and roundabouts thing. You say you can't do that thing in Continuum, but you can do the thing, as in John Carpenter's The Thing. This would be a very good game for modeling that kind of horror. And it does have that flexibility built into not only the background, but also the rules, if you're willing to either plow through them or cut them down enough to create the game entity that you want to. There's a lot in there. There's a lot of richness. As I said, I don't think I could play this. I would read the hell out of a set of novels in this background by disparate authors, collections of short stories. You could do so much within this. It's a really well put together universe if what you're looking for is something that does everything.
I'll have to send you some of the fiction that they've done. They have done some anthologies.
Oh, fantastic. And
there's After the Fall is the big one. They have some other short stories too.
That's, I must jump in and say, I did not, this is a game, it's one of those games that doesn't do examples of play. It does do little snippets of kind of in-game narrative from characters commenting on certain things. And there is a short story at the front of the game. And I did not take to that short story because, for me, it was not illustrating something that would really happen in a game. It didn't feel like a role-playing session. It actually felt mostly quite dull and a lot of explaining of background.
I felt like that was the one where it's like, okay, this is your character was this impoverished person from the favelas, and then you died on Earth, and 20 years later, you woke up in a new body because your dirtbag brother had you backed up.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Why isn't that the character generation system, that you generate who you were on Earth before the fall, and then you wake up, and it's all new?
Because all your characters could be, you know, because there are lots of characters who didn't have that background. I randomly rolled up a character, and it was one of them uplifted gorillas.
Mm-hmm. You could literally play like a video game character and an MMO that developed intelligence and escaped. So you could be like the shopkeeper of World of Warcraft who like, oh God, I'm a video game character. I need to get out. And then, you know, lives in or you could play like a 200-year-old human who saw the emergence of this technology and remembers life before uplifting and sleeving. And, or you could play, an intelligent gorilla. It accommodates a wide variety of character types, but the life path system I do like for character generation. In the first edition, it was actually even more time consuming to make characters. They've actually simplified it. Yeah.
So there was session zero for character generation and then session 0.5 for more characters generation.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Yeah. But yeah, like one of my favorite things is like, if you look in this book, page 368, threats and X risks, that's just fun to read of like all the messed up things that can be like scenario ideas. I mean, there's a lot of ideas you could use for other sci-fi RPGs, right? You know, like talking about mega engineering projects, and they like on page 380, they have the X-humans listing like why they're bad and things that they can do. And like, you know, what happens when somebody just jacks themselves up with existing technology as far as they can go? It's like, oh, well, that's bad. It's bad. Yeah. And then the Exurgent virus, of course, which is both, a basilisk hack. You just look at something and your brain gets hacked, or a biological pathogen, or a digital virus, or a nanovirus, nanoplague, sorry. And
the only way you can get cool psychic powers.
Yep. Yep. Because we don't understand how they work.
Because they stay with your ego and not your sleeve, which means, that's very weird.
Like the listing of the exurgent types and strains, There's some real, like, yeah, Cronenberg body horror stuff going on in there. So, yeah, it's very
cool. Yeah, when you were saying, James, that you could do the thing with this, I'm like, yeah, I can think of at least three things that could be the thing.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's very good. I think my favorite is the Skrick on page 394, which are tiny creatures coughed up by biomorphs infected with the strain, the Skrick strain of the exurgent virus. Yeah, they have a picture of a Nova crab, which is a you know, crab-like podmorph, puking up smaller crabs. And yeah, that could be for any.
What page is that?
394.
How'd I miss this? Oh, yep, there he is.
Yeah. So you could just have, you could do that for humans, just puking up tiny little people to swarm over you.
No.
Yeah, you're really only limited by your creativity. So, and then, of course, there's things like the factors as well, which are, you know, weird aliens that no one knows. Like, one thing also is Eclipse Stage does define a lot of things, but a lot of the grand reasons and the things are just left up to the GM to decide, like, who the factors really are. You know, what the Titans are really up to, and who Ozma is or what Ozma is really up to. And like, there's a lot of, possibilities,
but they list your possibilities for you. Yes.
Well, they list some possibilities, like, you know, obviously
it's not just, oh, we're leaving this up to the GM and not giving you any guidance.
Yeah, like on 407, they have Titan rumors, and the GMs can choose which of these are true. And there's a list of Titan things that people think are possible. You know, the Titans left because they perceive some other more important imminent threat. The Titans had a method for deactivating, or the factors had a method for deactivating the Titans, which they use, but it may not be permanent. The Titans built the Pandora Gates. You know, like, well, yeah, the Pandora Gates. Who built them? What are they for? Are they a trap? Do you actually go through a gate to another world on the other side of the galaxy? Or is that just a simulation? And people just don't know.
Oh, man. Yeah, if I was running it, it would totally just be a simulation. And everyone would find out and they'd be so sad and disappointed. And they'd say, damn it, Craig, why are you such a fucking buzzkill?
But they ship things again from Pandora Gates.
It'd be great.
Back to Mars, you know, back to where the gates are. So that machine is somehow creating that raw material to send through.
Sure.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Just another fabricator.
So, yeah, Eclipse Days is a playground for all of these ideas and more. But it's a very challenging playground to get into, I think, is sort of the biggest thing, at least for me. Because, like I said, it took me a year to get used to this. And then after that, it really clicked. Like, the first game I ran of it was like a tutorial where I had players start in simulated reality. We said, here's, make a skill test. Okay, here's how this works. Oh, your little VR game, your simulated, you know, virtual reality game has stopped broken. Turns out there are all these robots attacking. Oh, no, it's the fall. Better get to the spaceship, you know, to get off Earth before it's too late. And then we did a time skip to the actual mission. But I think something like that could be good if you wanted to run it. Like, one of the factions in the game is called the Jovian Republic, and they're bioconservative and like very like, oh, they're often compared to like space North Korea, or space, like, you know, American Republicans, everything, very paranoid, very distrustful technology.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do a game where players start as Jovians in a little suburb in their space station. And then they find out, and, you know, obviously they're not told about what's going on in the rest of the solar system. But they escape, or they have to flee, and they find out the truth. Each session, you introduce more and more concepts of Eclipse Phase as they yeah.
Escape from the space Tories, coming soon.
But yeah, James, any final thoughts on Eclipse Phase? There anything we haven't gone over?
As I say, there's an awful lot in there. I did not get on with it, which is one of the reasons that I've been fairly quiet this time. I think if I was going to do something with it, I would slice it right back. And this is something I talked about in an earlier episode, and I can't remember which system we were talking about. But I think this is a game that will actually do a really good job of handling William Gibson's The Peripheral, which is now reasonably well known from the Amazon series, which is not the same as the book, and I preferred the book a lot. But you could really model the future of The Peripheral in this and then do the whole thing of the split off, I'm forgetting what they call it, the the divergent timelines.
The stubs.
You could really handle that in an interesting way using this rule system, using the parts of this background. And I am intrigued by that world. I actually thought that the sequel to The Peripheral I found hugely disappointing. It is a book in which lots of people run around and nothing actually happens. But The Peripheral itself, the basic book, so rich with ideas. I just wish...
The Peripheral is amazing. I will second James's love for it. I didn't think Agency was that bad. I thought Agency was like, you know, there's a twist in The Peripheral and you can't retwist it for the sequel.
No. I love the way that Gibson does world building, which is usually hinting at something and then 50 pages later hinting about it again in a slightly different direction. He does very little direct world building. Whereas Eclipse Phase is just very direct world, you know, worlds upon worlds upon worlds and background upon background upon background, the density. I found a word processor that would accept it. The book is 350,000 words. That would take you at an average grown-up's reading speed about 20 hours to read. And that's assuming that this is a rule book that, you know, a GM feels that they have to read and assimilate most of the information of. That's quite an undertaking. That's a lot of work to
ask. It's a heavy lift.
It is. And given that when we're recording this, early February 2023, we've just been through, and we're not going to allude to this much, but we've been to the whole thing of WotC trying to recuse the old OGL, which caused an awful lot of people within the games community, particularly on social media, to go, this is fantastic. We can direct people to new role-playing games and new role-playing experiences and get them away from D&D finally, which is never going to happen. But this comes up from time to time. And inevitably, the conversation goes, well, what games should we direct them to? At which point, about 80% of the audience name their favorite role-playing game, whether it's an introductory game or not. This has been going on for about 30 years. I'm kind of tired of it. But you have to remember, D&D, yes, three big rule books, but even the biggest one is only 256 pages. Eclipse Phase is almost double that.
Yeah.
Have to read it. To run D&D, you only actually have to read the DM's guide. You don't have to read the player's handbook. That's for the players. The players need to know that information.
If you're running D&D, you need to know what your characters can do.
Pretty much. Or you can have the players do it. Yeah, it's a point. But I think to run Eclipse Phase,
I remember back in the old D&D days, where someone was running a playtest of, they're like, oh yeah, game set in the desert. So, and this was something they were writing professionally. They're like, so yeah, can we get someone who's just totally optimized to make water? Because a lot of the problems in this, a lot of the challenges are going to be water-based. And someone's like, okay, so yeah, I'm a water shaman with water affinity and from a species that gets water bonuses, and I can create 2,000 gallons of water of pure water every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're like, okay. So, and that's with spells that are already published. Yeah. Okay. We're just going to have to assume that people have water.
Yeah. But to get to the point, if you're wanting people to move off a game that they already know, to say, okay, well, what you're going to have to do is assimilate a 430-page rule book of dense stuff. And this is a beautiful book. My God, the quality of the art in this. The layout is crisp and clean. It looks really good. This is a very approachable and well-laid-out book. And yes, it's my
friggin' tablet. How many pages would they lose if they... lose if they didn't use the future conditional? if you took every instance of will in there, it would probably fill up two whole pages.
I just lost a bet with myself.
You thought I wasn't going to bring it up. I will never not bring it up if it's there.
But yeah,
I'm the last angry man, James.
Okay. But I think, if you go back to the time when Ross, I actually have no idea how old you are, but Greg, I'm guessing you got into roleplay about the same time I did. The FGU games and stuff like that, 64 pages of rules and quite, you know, possibly a separate scenario in the box if you were lucky. And that was everything. That was background, character generation, tasks, equipment, and combat, and the lot, 64 pages. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of good stuff in Eclipse Phase, but I would have done a much tighter rule book. And I think it would sell better as a much tighter rule book. And then these are the core books that you want, breaking out some of the other stuff. You know, if you want information on this, go to this supplement. It would be more approachable. Role playing has never been more popular than it is now. And yet we're still at a time that, what, 80% of the population think Monopoly is a complicated game. Monopoly is a game that used to print its rules on the inside of the box lid. I want more role-playing games that print their core rules on the inside of the box lid. Also, I want more role-playing games in boxes because I'm old school. But we
boxes
need...
are expensive, James.
I know, and over here they incur sales tax, VAT, as we call it, because boxed products are clearly not books. They're books in boxes, and that's that. Anyway, I like Eclipse Phase for its ambition and its sense of scale. What I would like is a much cleaner focus on the core of how the game actually works. Because if I had read like a 2 or 3 page boil down of this is how you play the game, which is not what is in their starter set. Their starter set, right. I just found, I was put off, as I said, put off running it by the starter set, which is not a good thing. I think part of the problem that role-playing games have with wider accessibility, non-D&D role-playing games, is 450-page rule books, because that's become a new standard now. We're looking at Call of Cthulhu was that big. Couple Guy of the other Crow. Ones we've... Yeah. Yes, it's become a new standard. We were talking before Warhammer, we started recording. Warhammer Zweihänder we were talking about too. These are... They are huge games. And yes, some people will really grok that, but an awful lot of people will be put off simply by the size and density of that stuff.
Well, part of that is the problem that collecting games and reading games is a different hobby from playing games.
Absolutely.
And, the collectors and readers, it's like, yeah, bring it on. More's better.
Yeah.
People who actually play are like, oh, yeah, I found this slick, fast little 40-page number.
Yeah, and I'm going to use it for everything now.
The other thing I'm going to say about the length of Eclipse Phase, you can get the whole text for free, right?
Yeah.
And it's always been free.
Yeah, it is Creative Commons, yeah.
If that had been around when I was a cheapskate teenager, I would have gotten the free version, and I would have read it obsessively until I could run it, and I would have felt like I was winning at everything, because I'm like, ha ha ha, I got this huge, elaborate, extensive, well-written game for free. And then eventually I would love it enough that I would save up my money and buy it. I mean, I've got Rain has come out in a new, richly illustrated form, and I'm trying to decide if I want to do some kind of open license on it or allow people to do stuff with it. And one of the, you know, some of the stuff I'm looking at is that, okay, WotC tried to create a walled garden, and they couldn't do it with Hasbro money. Powered by the Apocalypse is like, eh, do whatever you want. Morkborg is like, eh, do whatever you want. Eclipse Phases is like, here, have the book for free. And that hasn't seemed to hurt them.
No.
So,
no.
I don't know. What do you guys think? What do you think? And fans listening to this who are on the Discord, tell me what you think.
You know, it's interesting about, you know, the page length thing, because I just saw a mention. I just found out, you know, Goodman Games, they published Dungeon Crawl Classics, and so I sort of follow them. They just put out a new game or recently called Weird Frontiers RPG, a weird Western RPG. It's compatible with Dungeon Crawl Classics. It is over 900 pages.
Oh, good Lord.
And it is $75 for the print plus PDF version. And this DCC, the rules are, like, it's bog simple, but it's like 200 spells, contraptions, elixirs, 12 playable classes, blah, blah, blah. Clearly, the market seems to be going towards the high end, like the boutique, prestige, like, I want this big fuck-off book.
Well, yeah. It's easier to sell one $50 book to one rich collector than it is to sell five $10 books to, five different.
There's this economy of scale, right? Like, it is hard to get a book out and ship it and distribute it and store it and all that jazz. And
and nobody wants to do that for the 40-page. Although this is, the zines are the backlash because they're finding ways around it. They're like, yeah, okay.
But like, those are different play experiences. And I think like A Close Phase is very geared towards trying to hit these very hard to like, these very sort of abstract like science fiction ideas that are like, I don't think you could really get Eclipse Phase if you cut it into smaller books or trim it down, because it's about the whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
I see. Yeah. It's like, you know, you people are, for a practical term, just going to be like, oh, this is emphasizing ego hacking, mm-hmm. but to get the full experience, it's going to be like, yeah, but at some point your ego hacker is going to run into
it's about the interplay between the ego hacking and like the uplifts and like the AGIs and every reputation economy, just everything interacts with everything else. And it's about that interplay between those, you know, like you're dealing with this like existential threat that like these AIs, this virus that can wipe out everything. But you have all these tools to deal with it, and some may make it worse and some may make it better. And you can like, well, how do you like, okay, well, I'm going to fork myself and send myself to my certain death. You know, what does that say about myself? Like if I'm willing to do that, like there's, in a sense, you can't reduce it to what it is, but without like making it something else, like a game about ego hack or ego, you know, sleeving and forking and that kind of thing would be interesting. A game about like nanotechnology and fabrication would be interesting, but like Eclipse is about all these things and more. You could certainly argue that mechanics could be revised and better, and I think that's always true for pretty much every game, but like
always room at the top.
Yeah, exactly. But I think the setting and the concepts are, it's about all of it. And that's why I think it's great. And it's not for everybody, but like for those people who want to try something really different, like a game where all these things are, it's a game like no other science fiction game feels like this in my experience of playing them, because it actually feels like I am in a different society. I am playing in a different world. It's not just like the real world, but there's this one thing that's different. You know, like, think about the movie RoboCop. They have the technology to put someone's mind in a cyborg body and mess with his memories and do all this stuff, but they just do it to RoboCop. They don't use it anywhere else. They don't do anything else with it. It's just RoboCop. And it's like, well, does that really make sense? Wouldn't they use that technology in other ways?
They try. It needs a particular type of brain. That's what RoboCop 2 is about.
Yeah, true.
Actually, RoboCop 2 is about a big fight between robots.
Yeah, yeah. So, but you get my point. Like, that's why I like Eclipse Phase. It's definitely not an introductory game, and it's definitely not for everybody. But like, for those people it is for, it's great. It's an unmatched experience in that way.
A passionate defense.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I think I mentioned I am slightly biased.
You would not be qualified for this job if you hadn't done work on games. I mean, so there's always going to be these conflicts of interest, but I don't think you're being immoral. I don't think Adam Jury is, you know, waiting to, you know, as soon as this comes out, he's like, okay, check your PayPal.
yes.
Because what game publisher has that kind of budget?
That's why I got into RPG podcast and the big bucks. Yeah, that payola.
Bigger bucks, yeah.
Yeah, it's easy to get rich doing this if you're crooked. Yep.
So before we go, I would of course like to thank, we'd like to thank our backers.
Was Julian Whitehead, AKA SeaGoat777. Thank you for your support.
I know SeaGoat777 from the Rookery forums, where I also, occasionally stream. I was reminded, and I would like to thank the Ludaquist, a very fine board game cafe in Croydon, South London, where I've had many happy afternoons and evenings, and where, in fact, we had the launch party for my latest book, Everybody Wins, hey. 4 decades of the greatest board games ever made, now out in the UK and doing well, and launching in America and Canada in March. Pre-order now and help my algorithms. Thank you.
All right. Ross, anything you want to promote at this point?
The RPPR Patreon, I am offering online games for backers at the $10 level or higher, but also consulting. If you want me to take a look at an RPG thing you're doing or want advice for running a game, I've started helping out with that. Also I've been doing some writing up new cursed artifacts for RPPR Illustrated. So if you want to see what the cursed book of the Chronicler is, there's some really great artwork of it. Having some fun creating some new artifacts you can throw in different games. Last month I did the Simulacrum Engine, which is a big machine that makes clones of people, but they're wrong. There's an actual play of Mothership for it where you can hear it in play. And there's a little write-up for it too, along with artwork. So yeah.
All right. And as I mentioned, the long, long awaited second edition of Reign is out. Not all the setting book, but the first two books, the rules and the core setting I did for it, you can now get those on DriveThruRPG. I'm also encouraging people to check out the zine version of my two-player, no GM game, Million Dollar Soulmate from Indie Press Revolution, because that may not be available for much longer. There is a $10. We were talking about selling a $10 game to 5 people. Here's where the rubber hits the road. You can get Million Dollar Soulmate for $10 in a handsome zine format, full color.
Cool.
So,
there
it is.
Thank you all for listening. And in our next episode, we'll be talking about initiative systems and probably the action economy in RPGs, sort of a related topic. And what do we mean by that? Well, you'll have to stay tuned to find out. But until then, we'll talk to you later. Bye.
Ta-ta.
Later.